Grizzly One.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WAPC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Liar! 7 minutes after the hour of 5. Great song by Arjen, and it fits so well. Shamuel Hefe, Chris Christie, who is getting batted in this Bridgegate trial. He's been caught lying time and time again, most recently in the testimony of an aide who said, I tipped the governor off a day in advance of that major press conference he had in which he claimed he had no idea that his surrogates, namely Barone and Kelly, were stopping and putting into place the lane closures on the George Washington Bridge. To get an update on the trial and also the Trump campaign, we go to Mike Kelly, columnist for The Record. Thanks for joining us on the Drive Home at 5 again, Mike.
Hey, Curtis. It's always good to be with you.
So you had a column that said the governor sinks in a sea of obscenities. I want to play a cut the other day that he had when he was on WFAN, which seems to be his place to be. Maybe that'll be his future as a sports broadcaster when he leaves Trenton. But he was, I think, a bit of a sanctimonious hypocrite.
On the video itself, let's be really clear, it is completely indefensible. And I won't defend it and haven't defended it.
Do you think the apology was enough?
I didn't think it was. And I, on Friday or Saturday, and I told him that. I would have done it much differently. But, you know, I do think he's sorry, and I do think he's embarrassed by it. No question in my mind about it. I was there when he found out about it, and there's no question in my mind he's embarrassed by it. I'm still supporting Donald. You know, obviously I was disappointed by what happened, but you know, and disappointed in some respects by the response initially, but I'm still supporting him.
Gee, he wanted the apology from Donald Trump to be better performed, but he hasn't apologized for that sea of obscenities that have been pouring out of that courtroom that are attributed to them, has he?
No, not at all. And getting back to what he said about Donald Trump, I think the real issue with Christie is why was he silent for several days? If he was critical of Donald Trump, why didn't he say so immediately? And I thought Christie just sat back and allowed Donald Trump to go forward with the debate, and then Christie just sort of sat back to see what the outcome would be. And now we know that the governor is not approving of Donald Trump. Well, gee, I don't think that's a great shock, because most of the country doesn't approve of what Donald Trump was saying. So now the governor's finally weighing in. And then taken against the backdrop of the way the governor has been quoted by various people as talking, particularly dropping the F word frequently and that sort of thing, you have to wonder about, you know, exactly who is the real Chris Christie, and is he able to speak, you know, calmly or you know, using the F word in every other phrase.
Well, you almost think conjures up an image, because he always made reference to his mother, his Sicilian mother, maybe right. Using the Fells naphtha soap and just washing his mouth out. And then the other day in court, his top aide who had replaced Barone dropped dime on him and said, hey, the day before he had that press conference where he told the world he knew nothing about Bridgegate and the lane closings, I told him what had happened.
You know, it's worse than that, Curtis. You're absolutely correct. His close aide, close friend, Deborah Gamruccioni, who he appointed to take Barone's spot in the Port Authority, she basically outed him by saying, "Yes, you were the day before you went before everybody and acted as if you knew nothing about the Sergeant Schultz routine. I knew nothing." Well, in fact, you know, people were talking about that, but it goes back even farther than that, Curtis. And actually, the day before, in August, when Bridget Kelly sent that, you know, the famous time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, when she sent that email to David Wildstein in August of 2013, about 3 weeks before the actual lane closures took place, that very day, she was having lunch with Deborah Garrucioni and Governor Christie.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never really learned what caused Bridget Kelly to send that email. It's never really added up very well, because the Christie administration knew for a long time that the mayor of Fort Lee was not going to endorse Chris Christie. So why in the middle of August of 2013 did Bridget Kelly suddenly come up with this notion to send an email to David Wildstein, which essentially set in motion these lane closures? And Bridget Kelly's attorney revealed in court yesterday that on that very day, Bridget Kelly and Deborah Garrucioni were having lunch together with the governor.
Incredible. But anyway, I want to take you down to Florida. Earlier today, sure. Donald Trump said that if he doesn't win, it'll be like the worst time he's ever spent in his life.
If I don't win on November 8th, I will consider this the single greatest waste of time, energy, and money of anything I've ever done.
Now, would that be true? Because in your most recent column, you said, Mike Kelly, Trump may finally have done himself in.
Oh, I think it's over, Curtis. I really do. You can kind of feel it. Hillary Clinton is by no means a lock, but she has this innate ability to trip over herself, and I'm sure she will find all kinds of ways to trip over herself over these coming weeks. But you can feel that something dramatic has happened, that this was a kind of turning point. And as I suggested in my column, that this might have been it. I mean, we've gone through these whole series of events, haven't we, Curtis? I mean, it started with the Mexican rapists and knocking John McCain's war service, et cetera. And, you know the list. It's a long litany of, and, you know, having that fight with the Gold Star family and stuff. Trump seems to kind of go off on these tangents. I think this incident with Billy Bush on the bus and the so-called locker room talk, I think that was over the top, and that coupled with Trump's debate performance, which I don't think was very good. Although I think he didn't do as badly as people thought he would, because Clinton did not do very well. But you can feel that there's a change in the wind right now.
I know, but with Speaker of the House Paul Ryan cutting all ties, other than to say he'll vote for Trump, doesn't that affect other members on the ticket all the way down the line, the Senate, the House, that if you cut adrift your presidential nominee, how can you expect his supporters to vote for your candidates?
Well, the real question here, Curtis, is will there be a Republican Party to actually work on Election Day to get out the vote? I mean, I think there will be some counties around America where the Republican Party will be very, very strong, and they will get out the vote. But by no means are we talking about a unified party marching into a national election, and that is a big problem for Donald Trump.
Now, Mike Kelly, my signature issue in this campaign, since there are so many issues, as you mentioned, for people to latch on to, has been Donald Trump's performance in the Hofstra debate, first debate, and the second debate this Sunday night in St. Louis has nothing to do with the content. It has to do with his constant sniffling. Which I got to tell you, Mike, in each of the debates against Hillary were over 100 sniffles counted.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, in the many Republican debates that he had, oftentimes when he had to get loud and abrasive, never heard a sniffle. In the many interviews he's done on radio or TV, never a sniffle. The town hall meetings like yesterday in Florida, not a sniffle. What do you think it is that when he's standing there with Hillary, all of a sudden, we're going through Sniffergate?
I know. I noticed it as well. I have a theory on that, Curtis, and this is just pure amateur doctor. Okay, can I lay it out?
Oh, of course, of course.
I think he gets so emotionally wrapped up that I would love to have a heart monitor on this guy as he's standing there. I think he gets so emotionally wrapped up that he's almost panting for breath here. He strikes me, Curtis, as an extraordinarily angry guy. He's kind of like those guys you meet at a bar who they just start in and they just can't stop. Well, that to me, Donald Trump is like the guy at the other end of the bar who just needs to be heard. And my sense is the debate went on, he was getting more and more and more frustrated. I mean, notice his answer when Anderson Cooper tried to press him on the quote-unquote locker room talk and had he ever engaged in groping women and that sort of thing, as he said he did, you know. And he started to talk about that. He tried to label his locker room talk, and then he immediately switched into his pledge to bomb ISIS. It was almost like, you know, apples and oranges. And my sense from all of this is that he was trying to all of these thoughts were conflating in his head all at once. And I just think he was just overwhelmed by it. And I'm sure he just gets so emotionally caught up, he can't even get out a simple, coherent sentence.
Well, I think that may be a good suggestion that Donald have to wear a Fitbit for the third debate in Las Vegas Wednesday, which we'll be broadcasting here from 770 AM WABC, or have his blood pressure monitored like I have mine each and every day with Ron Kuby, who you can hear me with, whose mommy is a commie 12 to 3. And oftentimes my blood pressure hits 220 over 120. Oh, yeah, I know all about those anger management issues, that's for sure.
The Drive at 5, on the air, on the app. Curtis Sliwa, live, local, on it, 77 WABC.
I'll be Mac the Knife. There's a tugboat down by the river.
524. I remember as a kid growing up in the era of Greasers, Mac the Knife was one of those Greasers songs, and it was sung by Bobby Darin, who went as a Bronx kid to the Bronx High School of Science, considered a brainiac. Many would say it was a school of nerds and, well, those who are geeks. And then all of a sudden, in reading the front page of the Daily News today with their exclusive story, they have Facebook videos revealing an elite fight club that exists on the campus at Bronx High School of Science with the headline, "Put Up Your Dorts." Ben Chapman, education reporter for the New York Daily News, say it ain't so that some of our elite brainiac, dorky students in the city are actually trying to punch each other out?
Hey, Curtis, that's exactly what's happening. They got a Facebook group with about 1,500 members, and for better than a year, they've been scheduling fights in the park across the street from Bronx Science. And then, you know, turning up for the fights after school, filming them, posting them to the Facebook site, and, you know, then critiquing the fights and making flyers to promote the next one. So it appears to be some kind of a, you know, violent hazing thing.
You know, Ben, when I first started the Guardian Angels up in the Bronx back in 1979, we used to be asked to come over to that same park you described across the street from Bronx High School of Science near Bedford Park and wait there to escort the geeks and dorks to the Bedford Avenue train station, both the D and 4 train. Because the guys from nearby Clinton High School on Missoula Parkway, just a block away, 4,000 guys, vulturized them every day for their lunch money and anything they could get on. And these kids were so frightened and intimidated. Where did they suddenly develop this chutzpah?
I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I mean, if you look at the videos and they are posted on our website, you'll see that the fights are pretty tame. We're not talking about dismemberment here. We're talking about a lot of slapping and wrestling. There are, you know, bloody noses and bloody lips and bloody knuckles, but they're not dismembering each other. There's no dead bodies.
No, but, you know, in the streets, I used to get involved in slap boxing all the time. So at least it's a step up from just turn and run, which is what the Bronx High School kids used to do. Now, is this limited? Is this like gender limited where it's only guys involved? Because boys and girls go to Bronx High School of Science.
Yeah, there are male and female members of the Facebook group where they're sharing the videos and promoting these things. However, in the videos, I've only noticed male students fighting.
Now, are their parents aware of this? Because many of them would consider this a udiscrazia, a shanda, because they have images of their sons and daughters going to Ivy League institutions, becoming CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, or like George Tenet, the former CIA director, used to come all the way from Astoria to go to Bronx High School of Science, and so many others who've done so well in society in the past.
Yeah, well, that's right, you know, and I haven't talked to a ton of parents, but the ones that I have spoken to have been super upset, really upset. You know, they're super disappointed, you know, they just think that the students are acting, you know, super entitled and bratty, and you know, that they shouldn't be doing this. So the the folks that I've talked to are really bummed out about it.
Well, you know, the film, the actual film Fight Club, I loved, especially when Ed Norton punched himself into the trophy case. That was a classic, you know, as he was talking back and forth about the violence self-inflicted and inflicted on others with Brad Pitt. But in this case, you mean to tell me one of these dorks, one of these geeks, one of these brainiacs actually threatened one of your Daily News reporters?
Yeah, so basically what happened was after our article posted last night, they posted my home phone number to the website, to their Facebook group, and they just started calling me all night long. I got about 27 phone calls, and then I got about 40-something messages on my Facebook, you know, and a bunch of voicemails. Some of it threatening. I mean, it all sounds like, you know, you're kind of, you know, nice kid who goes to Bronx Science High School. They don't sound bloodthirsty, but, you know, we still got to take it seriously. The police are going to get involved. I got to go fill out a police report about it.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you, because, Ben, you understand, just like the next issue we're going to be talking with Roger Stone is, was he involved with the Russians in hacking Podesta's DNC emails that Podesta is claiming on behalf of Hillary? These kids are so proficient in hacking. Man, they are going to be breaking into everything you've ever written or done privately, publicly. Do you realize that, Ben? They'll launch an all-out hacking jihad against you.
Yeah, it sure looks like that. It sure looks like that. I mean, they have taken photos from my Facebook, and, you know, like I said, they've been calling me and emailing and texting. So, you know, I won't be surprised if it escalates.
Now,
so, you know, that's why we are taking precautions.
Have you heard anything from the DOE, what I call the dumbest organization ever, the Department of Education led by Chancellor Farina, or any deans or disciplinarians at the school?
Yeah, the school principal has not been returning my emails, but I have been in contact with the folks at Tweed at the Department of Education, and basically, you know, they say that they're investigating the incidents, and they do have a sort of system-wide code of conduct for appropriate online behavior, but what's less clear is what methods they have for enforcing this code of conduct or monitoring students' behavior online. And when you look at what we have here, which is a group of 1,500 individuals, are members of this super active online community that's existing, like, independent of the school, yet still affiliated with the school, I think it raises some interesting questions about how the heck is the city even going to get its arms around this to, you know, figure out what's going on and try and, you know, monitor and police what kids are doing online outside of school.
Well, I must tell you, Ben Chapman, there is one positive silver lining here. I never thought we'd have to call on the geeks, the dorks, the brainiacs of Bronx High School of Science to fight ISIS. But we know up at that bucolic campus on Bedford Park in the Bronx are young men who are prepared to punch each other out and themselves out, like Ed Norton in the Fight Club, who would be more than happy to serve America in the battle against ISIS. Although, as Ben Chapman pointed out, pimp slapping their way to victory.
Curtis Lewa, The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser
39.
Since my
as the headlines today
goodbye.
With an additional 1,700 WikiLeaks drops about the DNC communications that mostly came in and out of the email suppository, I'm going to call it, because that's what it's become, for John Podesta. He's the number one aide to camp to the election effort of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And day after day, WikiLeaks, through Assange, has been dropping these promised emails, which have been scoring a direct hit. And if Donald Trump wasn't imploding and deciding to fight more against his fellow Republicans than the Clintonistas, it might be taking its effect in terms of the polls. But today, John Podesta said enough is enough, because he knows for the next 20-odd days before the general election tally on the 8th, there are going to be drops each and every day. There are tens of thousands of other emails that have been purloined by WikiLeaks. He's claiming it's through the Russians, through their new modern KGB. But he's also making the claim that Roger Stone, the political hitman extraordinaire who knows where all the bones are buried and who buried them, and has worked for Richard Nixon, has worked for Republican candidates, and in fact, if you remember, most infamous and famous for screaming out in the recount of the ballots in Florida, Bush versus Gore 2000. You remember that. The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. And immediately the count was stopped. It was reconfigurated and eventually decided 8 weeks later by a United States Supreme Court decision that decided Bush 43 would become the president and not Al Gore. And you saw Al Gore reminding us of that yesterday in his campaign appearance, talking about global warming, its devastating effects, as he was side by side with Hillary in Florida, the very state that determined the outcome of that general election. And also, naturally, the role of a third-party candidate, Ralph Nader, which he continues to blame for the fact that he did not become president of the United States after Bill Clinton. But it is so interesting when you read these emails, because the one thing that it shows over and over again about Hillary Rodham Clinton and the Clintonistas who were working for and have been working for to make her the next president of the United States is her public struggles in trying to define her politics at that very moment of communication. And more importantly, her apparatchiks, her sycophants, toadies, and lackeys, as they're communicating back and forth with their emails to John Podesta, to one another, asking the question, what reason does she have to become president of the United States? And in fact, if you look at email after email, there's little or no discussion about what Hillary actually thinks or believes, just about the political advantages of taking one position or another. On the line now to discuss the accusations made against him earlier today by John Podesta is, in fact, Roger Stone. Thanks for jumping on board here at the Drive at 5, Roger.
Great to be here.
Okay, so John decided to point the finger at you, in addition to the Russians and WikiLeaks, and say you're the Trinity, you're the Troika, you are a cabal that has done this to the Democrats.
Yeah, this is nonsense. First of all, I categorically deny that I had any advance knowledge that his emails were going to be hacked, but I think it's understandable in the game of politics that he would like to deflect attention from what's in his emails to, you know, Roger Stone. John Podesta has been involved in money laundering for Russian interests for the Clinton Foundation. He's also been involved in money laundering for the purposes of selling American defense and military technology to the Russians, I believe, illegally. So you can understand why they would like to get the focus off of John Podesta, who runs the Clinton campaign, and on to Roger Stone. By the way, I am not and never have been an agent of the Russian government. I have no Russian clients. I've never received any money from Russia, nor am I receiving any now. I'm not in touch with anybody in the Russian government or Russian intelligence, but I do feel, Curtis, that I should confess that I do like a Stolichnaya martini very dry up with olives. That would be my sole Russian connection.
Okay, well, let's exempt the Russians from this discussion as we move forward. But he says that you've been in touch with Julian Assange, the founder and leader of WikiLeaks.
I admit that, and I've said so in public. That doesn't mean I've spoken with them or met with them. I have been in touch with them through an emissary. I, as you know, write for a website called The Stone Cold Truth. I have a radio show on Saturdays called The Stone Cold Truth, and I have been very interested in the entire WikiLeaks question, but that does not mean that I am privy to Mr. Assange's plans or changes in his plans or what he plans to do next. I understand that he has every email that Hillary Clinton's top aides, Huma Abedin and Cheryl Mills, thought that they had discarded, which may be why Hillary Clinton wrote an email suggesting that perhaps we should kill Mr. Assange with a drone strike, which, as you know, came out last week.
Yes. Now, finally, the sniffing that Donald Trump has had that has become so audible and noticeable in both debates against Hillary, which never existed before in his debates on the Republican stage or in his many interviews or the town hall meetings that he has virtually each and every day and night. What do you think that comes from?
I don't know. I am mystified. You know, I've actually had people ask me whether this could be related to some kind of drug habit, and I must tell you, Trump doesn't even take aspirin. Never had a glass of wine in his life. He's adamantly opposed to drugs, drinking, and smoking. So that's not possible. This is some kind of post-nasal problem. And I hope he sees a doctor, but I must tell you, I found it distracting and mystifying.
Can't they do something to the microphone, like they adjust this for me so I don't pop my peas? I mean, maybe a lapel mic this time, Roger, you can suggest, because they had the handheld mic in St. Louis. They had the stationary mic in Hofstra. Maybe a lapel mic so it's not as close to his nose.
Well, yes, but this is uncharacteristic. This is something I've never seen before, and I've known him 40 years, and I've seen recent television appearances in which, you know, this sniff or whatever it is was not present. So, if I were him, I'd just get to a doctor and have it checked out.
Well, there's nobody who would know better than Roger Stone. He knows where all the political bones are buried, who buried them going back to the days of Richard Nixon and virtually every Republican presidential campaign since.
Curtis Sliwa, The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
As we continue on The Drive home at 5, it is the We Be Thugging update. And it's what City Hall and your mayor, not mine, Comrade de Blasio, does not want to hear. And that is that there is an uptick in crime in New York City. Because what is it that Bill de Blasio constantly lies to us about?
We are America's safest big city.
Oh, oofa. Well, apparently that didn't exist yesterday in a press conference that was held in One Police Plaza when head of the detectives, Boyce, had to announce that it had been a tremendous increase in crime in Central Park.
We have right now an uptick in crime in Central Park. Basically, crime in the park is down 17% this year. However, this past month, it's up substantially. 5 robberies versus 1. All of those 5 robberies are about cell phones.
Isn't it amazing, ladies and gentlemen, that they always have to preface it by indicating, but crime has been down in Central Park. All right, let's talk about what just transpired. 11:30 on Friday, a crew of 8 to 9 thugs beat and stomped a man walking near 69th Street and the East Drive, stole his phone and his tablet. At 11:30 on Sunday, a man on a bike was knocked to the ground near 95th Street and East Drive, beaten and robbed of his cell phone. At 10:30 at night on Monday, a victim was jogging near 110th Street and the East Drive near the Lasker Rink when she was attacked from behind. The man dragged her into a wooded area, removed her cell phone from her pocket, pulled her shirt over her head, punched and kicked her in the head, and sexually attempted to violate her. The attacker is described as being in his 30s and has a scruffy beard. His race is African-American. He was last seen wearing a dark jacket and an orange T-shirt. And so all of a sudden, naturally, the NYPD will flood the park with additional police officers, both undercover and in uniform. But it's an indication of what came out in the Daily News earlier today, that fewer frisks means less crime. Because the city of New York wants to be able to pretend to all of us, as Mayor de Blasio always says,
we are America's safest big city.
But the stop and frisk encounters have reached an all-time low. And that means you're not going to come into contact with people who are carrying weapons that are used to commit crimes, obviously hurt people and in some instances kill them. So the chance is that a lot of crimes that you would normally have found on the crime blotter will no longer exist. It makes One Police Plaza look good. But listen to some of the users of Central Park. They don't seem to be all that reassured by Comrade Bill de Blasio that the city is safer than it's ever been.
I think it's really scary. Like, I come here every day with the dogs, three times a day, and I always feel it's safe. So, yeah, that's really scary.
To be approached by, like, you said 6 to 8 guys, I mean, I would be really intimidated. So it's something to keep in mind when I'm walking across here in the morning.
And then a park advocate weighed in about crime, not just in Central Park, but other city parks.
There's not enough resources, and crime is down in New York City, but not in parks. Parks, they are dramatically up.
And he's absolutely correct. Up in Central Park, up in Prospect Park, up in Crotona Park in the Bronx, up in Flushing Meadow Park in Queens. And it's all about the fact that the thugs and the thuggettes have figured out the seams where the police are not, where the technology does not exist, where almost every crime that we see nowadays on the evening news is been taped either by somebody with their cell phone, their smartphone, or by some kind of a camera that has been put into place. Like, look at this most recent case of this vile jerk who beat a 66-year-old man on that M train in Brooklyn. Not only beat him up while he was being taped on a cell phone, but then scowled at the person who was taping him as he took the wallet out of the 66-year-old man's pocket and started counting the money. These are the kind of crimes that haunt people. And as the NYPD flexes itself, and as the mayor continues to say over and over ad nauseum,
we are America's safest big city.
I just remind all of you, there's still been no resolution to the Vetrano investigation of that horrible rape and murder of the jogger in Howard Beach. And what about the owner of Spumoni Gardens? They had video of the guy they said was responsible. I said it was organized crime. They said it was a straight-up robbery. They said that an arrest would take place almost any day, and we're still waiting. So you may want to believe the propaganda that comes out of One Police Plaza and City Hall each and every day about crime in the city, but I can't find one person in one neighborhood who feels any safer in the term of Bill de Blasio than they did before under Bloomberg or Rudy Giuliani.